cold enough for you guys? Ridiculous. I grew up in North Carolina, so I'm looking at these pictures from coming out of Georgia and stuff.
Wow. The strange difference in perception. I remember when I moved up here and I was standing at the bus stop with my kids and we were getting 8 inches of snow that day. It was blowing sideways and there was a 10-degree wind chill. I mean, it's minus 10 wind chill. And my kids are going to school. Oh, crap. Where I grew up, if it was even threatening the snow, they would have canceled school. But, I mean, there's no snow clouds. It's tough. Anyway, so last time we talked a bit about the human experience, sort of what it is that we normally can experience in terms of scales of the universe. And we talked a little about how that may bias our expectations. And it certainly biases our intuition and our models. And we're going to see repeated examples of that sort of in the course of the term. Things that sort of defy our intuition sometimes take time to be accepted. And even when they're clearly established, like I would say quantum mechanics, I mean, it's a battle for any student when they're learning quantum transformers to actually accept some of the underlying stuff intuitively. It's tough. We have a saying, I think you actually may run into it in some of the reading in mathematics this week, where don't think too hard, just shut up, calculate. Because if you think too hard about quantum mechanics, you sort of get into this infinite loop of twisted confusion. And so we'll talk a bit about why that is and everything. And I meant to apologize a little bit about the reading this week. Particularly Wigner's piece. I mean, he's a theoretical physicist. He's written this article that's probably more or less written for scientists. And when I read it, I thought there was a lot of interesting discussion, but he certainly is making references to very particular things that that may not be too meaningful to you. Just sort of slide through that. I mean, if you want to talk about some of those things. I mean, he's certainly talking about some things that I don't know what they are, the high-powered quantum mechanical stuff. So just sort of slog through that a little bit. Don't worry too much about the stuff that doesn't make too much sense. We also talked a bit about the nature of science and religion and art, and we could probably fill another hour easily, or two, or the whole course, talking about that. And I certainly don't mind coming back to those to pieces. And in fact, by design, there are pieces of the course which we will for sure. But let me now begin to concentrate more on science and physics and how we operate. But the essential thing that, to me, sets scientific methodology apart in terms of the way for us to understand our universe is that methodology has, at its very core, a systematic way and requirement of revising what you're thinking, what the model is, based on observations, based on new insights. So people are people, and scientists definitely adopt their favorite theories, and they can be religious about it. I don't know to what extent you might have picked up on it in the multiverse video, but Brian Greene is religious about string theory, and we'll talk about it now. You know, you have to be religious about some form of science. It's a pretty compelling thing. He has his reasons, but it verges on religion with him. And every book he writes is the same sort of thing that have come through in the movie. So lots of scientists will get their thing, and they'll fight to keep the picture from being revised if they are invested in it. And sometimes it's a very personal investment. It's like, well, mine is the paper that established this paradigm, So I'm going to fight you tooth and nail. If you tell me there's an observation that disagrees with this, I'm going to criticize that observation. I'm going to look at what you did. I'm going to see if I can fit it within the model without changing my paradigm. And it's actually part of the process of science, this personal thing, because, of course, this kind of criticism that comes from all different angles is a very important way of ensuring that the observations are actually good, because you have to stand up to the criticism. So it's a core piece of the methodology, and it is very seldom that you get major shifts in paradigm quickly. It almost always is a very chaotic and even controversial process. It is not clean and pretty by any stretch of the imagination. And you know, you should always remember that when you see the newspaper articles about, you know, the latest and greatest fabulous thing that just happened. Probably you're too young to remember this, but I remember when it was. There was, must have been in the early 90s or late 80s, about 1989 or something. I was in the physics department at Yale at the time, and I remember there was this huge news story broke because a couple of chemists had claimed that they had produced fusion, which is where you take nuclei and put them together and release energy, and basically test it in the laboratory. And if, in fact, you could do that, the energy problem would be solved forever in our world. And I remember sitting around the lunch table, and most of the scientists there were just incredulous about this, because it turns out that in order to take two nuclei and get them to fuse for this thing to happen, you literally take two things that have the same charge, electric charge, and you're shoving them together, and it takes a tremendous amount of energy to do that. And that amount of energy is not normally available at room temperature. So in fact, the only way, if we know, to make it happen, and the main way we know to make it happen is if you have a bunch of nuclei and you do a nuclear explosion, in fact, you can cause it to happen. LLE, this laboratory that's on the edge of campus, they take a laser that's about the size of a football field, and they take the beam and they send the beam in from some 90 different directions onto a pellet of tritium and implode it, and can put enough energy to come close to creating fusion. So it's a very hard thing to do, but I remember people just sitting around the lunch table just like, this just can't be true. And so some people actually went off and did experiments, and eventually, so it was this huge argument, and eventually it was shown to be basically pathological science, that they didn't do the science carefully. They sort of saw what they wanted to see, and then they published in the New York Times, basically, before the paper ever came out about scientific criticism. It came out in the New York Times. So, at any rate, you should always look at these things very critically. Revolutions do happen. And when they do, you're going to have the scientists sitting around the lunch table incredulous, thinking this can't happen. But once in a while, it turns out to be a big paradigm shift. But it's not very often. But you might look up cold fusion. It's sort of an interesting story, a particular one. But a piece of this is, it's not just about observation. That observation that you make and what it means for the model that you build or that you're considering also has to be consistent with everything else that you know. Yes?
There's a confusion. For instance, you don't like the idea of black hole. He tries it in some time of his life, so against it. Why is it doesn't fit into his model? Or
who? Einstein?
Yeah.
We'll actually talk a good bit about black holes, so we'll talk a bit more about it.
Is it because
I'll give you a quick answer, but then I'd like to sort of put it off, because in the course of the semester we'll have to talk about a lot of the issues, and we'll talk about it a bit. In Einstein's theory of general relativity, he views gravity as a distortion of space and time, and we're going to talk a lot about that this week. And so what that means is if you have a large enough energy in a small enough spot, it literally can take something the size of a star and collapse it down to a point. But a way to think about it is if I have a mathematical expression that has a 1 over r dependence, a 1 over distance dependence, when everything goes down to where the distance is 0, that blows up to infinity. So, as you'll see, I guess, in next week's recitation, I mean, I'm not trying to be overly math. I'm not going to do a lot of math in this class, but the force of gravity tends to go as 1 over distance squared. So if you look at the force of one object on another, mass in terms of gravitation, it drops as distance squared. So if I double the distance, it's 4 times less force. But that means if I come close together, it becomes infinite. And so in a black hole, what happens is you take that mass and it literally collapses. And the classical theory that he does in general relativity, there's nothing to stop it, so it goes to a point. And what that really means is that all physics as we know it becomes, the laws of physics as we understand them basically don't work. The mathematics that we use to understand things at a macro scale no longer work. So that leads to a lot of discomfort. And at least early on, and we still don't understand that problem. It turns out quantum mechanics probably solves it, and we'll talk about this through the course of the semester. So, okay. At any rate, so the human things that have your overall picture also has to work. For this cold fusion thing to be true, it basically probably with an energy conservation doesn't work, or something fundamental, and stuff that we understand very well in terms of electricity and magnetism and nuclear physics just would be thrown out the window. So it's really important to look at observations very carefully and critically. So what that means is that for science to work, you tend to have a community of people, and they have to make observations, they have to convey what it is they saw to other people who then have to look at that very critically, and maybe they try to repeat it, and you sort of go in this way. Different measurements are done, and it's sort of an ugly process, to tell you the truth. But what it means is that when you make an observation, you need to report it in a way that is as unambiguous as possible. And this, of course, is what leads, I think, to the basic nature, as we said, of science being cold. Or, if you want, it sort of takes, you want to take the ambiguity out of it, and it also leads to lots of layers of lingo, because you have to have very precise meanings for lots of things. And, you know, at least the writing is horrible. I mean, as an example, I pulled out an abstract of a paper I wrote a number of years ago, and, I mean, if you read this, it's just horrid. But it's just full of detail so that someone who's a basic expert in the field that I was studying at the time can look at it and know essentially what I did. And then when you go into the body of the paper, I mean, it's worse than this because everything has errors and it's all, you know. So it's just truly awful to go through it. In fact, it's you tend to write these things so that only an expert who's doing it can actually read it. So it's really hard to break into a new area. And the only way I've found to do it is I go and I get 30 review papers that different people have written in the area, put them in a big stack, and start trying to read them. And the truth is I start at the top and I can't read 90% of it. It doesn't make any sense to me, but I get 10% of it. Each author I find explains a little bit of stuff in a way that I can understand. And so as I go through the stack, I start understanding more and more of the papers, and then I go back up to the top and start over, and now I get to this top paper instead of 80% of it or something, I can actually understand, you know, 90%. Instead of not understanding 80%, I can understand, you know, 50% of it. And so I do this process a few times. So it's truly painful, and it does divorce, I mean, this was absolutely cruel work. Not why I chose this one. It turns out to have been a real... But it would take me an hour to try to give you a sense as to why, which is just ridiculous if you think about it. So it's a real shame. Science is so important to our society in so many ways, and yet in many instances, the significance, the true significance of specific things are just sort of lost to almost everyone except the very few people who are doing it. So it's really awful. At any rate, by virtue of what it's trying to do, it sort of dictates a lot about the way that science tends to operate. So, here we go. Comments from you? Anything else? Yeah.
Do you feel that scientific writing has become more and more blameless over time, or do you think it's just sort of...
Probably it has. I haven't done a lot of reading of older scientific writing. What is true is, to the extent that maybe it was always this way, the layers of language and the number of subspecialties has grown tremendously, to the point where I think it's more and more difficult to be conversant at a serious level broadly. And most scientists actually aren't. In fact, most of them do careers that are... They'll do a PhD measuring something, and they'll very often sort of repeat that through their whole career. They'll become the best person in the world at measuring, you know, this particular thing. And it does get better. They become very good at that, but it turns out that it's not just science that's its fault. A lot of it actually has to do with how we fund our science. Because the way that science is funded in the United States, and actually I think most of the world, but certainly in the United States, you put in a grant proposal to some funding agency, they then send it out to experts in that sub-area. So those experts in the sub-area can really evaluate that proposal, and they can decide to give you money. So once they do that, you do your work, you become an expert in that area. They then ask you to review others. And so what happens is you're known to very well internationally to a handful of these experts, and they're the ones who basically are then advising the funding agency as to who gets funded. So if you now want to go and switch areas into some other area because you have a cool idea but you're not yet a known expert in it, there's a huge barrier to actually getting funding. So you have to break into this new community. And it's sort of bizarre because there's truth, right? Because for you to break in, usually there's a fixed sum of money, and it basically means somebody else is losing money. So there's a built-in threshold for the reviewers to actually not lose money. So we have structurally things that actually take our scientists and try to keep them in their little boxes, which is a real shame, because I think that limits us, because I believe that you can get nice, unique, and creative insights from people who aren't basically invested in the paradigm all the time.
So that's yeah. So like if you got an idea, but the expert in the area like so disagree with you, you're not supposed to get funded because they might not advise the agent to give you.
It's not written in stone. That's not a rule. In fact, they would argue that no, if it's a good idea, we want to fund it. And they do. I mean, it does happen. You can break into the area, so don't get me wrong. But there is a little bit of that does happen, that if you come in with a new idea but you're not an established expert, it takes a few years before you can actually get funding. So it slows things down.
At any rate, it's all about observation in the end. And so let's look at what some of those implications are. Let's suppose you have this piece of chalk and you want to make an observation of it. And you needed to write
something about your observation to somebody across the world so that they could see what they think, what would you talk about?
How would you do it?
I need to talk about all the details, like what the mass of this job and how I interact with it, what did I do, what's the strength of it, it's like all numbers.
Shape, mass,
color.
Time, color,
texture.
Is it sitting here? Is it moving? Is it accelerating? There's a lot of stuff you have to talk about. So let's just start with position. What do we really mean by position? Or what is space? Yeah, I guess I think of space is the fabric in which we measure where something is the way I think about it.
We can only really talk about space sort of in terms of its relative position to other things, right? Like, how far it is off the floor, or its longitude and latitude.
That's actually, I think, a very deep question or comment. And I don't know that we have an answer. It is certainly true that the main way in which you use a concept of space is to measure relative positioning of things. That's the way in which it is most useful. But it is certainly a very real question to ask, is there an absolute frame that everything is measured, that in principle everything could be measured with respect to? So cosmologically that turns out to be a very bizarre concept in a way, because it turns out that one of the core principles in cosmology is that no matter where you are in the universe, if you look out at things, basically you'll see exactly the same thing. So it's a little bit hard to talk about the center of a universe when you sort of live in a place like that. And it turns out this is a very core principle in cosmology. So I think it's a very deep question that'll come up some. And in this idea of the multiverse, I think we'll find it almost makes no sense, because for there to be an absolute thing, you'd actually have to step out into the multiverse of this weird inflationary space where you have these different universes going. And I don't know what to think about what coordinate system you would try to use. So it's there's a lot to that. From our point of view, let's initially just assume that we can define a particular coordinate system. So that's really the way we have to operate. It's usually relative position. So in order to talk about, make a measurement, you basically are free to define your coordinate system. So we could say, for example, we're going to define the position of this piece of chalk by saying the zero of our coordinate system is, you know, that corner of Hoyt, and we could maybe tell the rest of the world where that is by giving, you know, a very particular latitude and longitude, which is a coordinate system on Earth, and GPS maybe can give us that or whatever. But then we can, once that's defined and everybody knows where it is and agrees on what that is, then we can talk about the location of this with respect to that, okay? And we have to decide what our units are, and we have to decide sort of how many numbers it takes. So when we talk about living in three-dimensional space, what we really mean is that I can define the position of this piece of chalk with three numbers. I can have a coordinate system, and I can say it's this many steps along the wall, this many steps this way, and that many steps up. Right? It takes three numbers to do it. You can sort of think of a fourth dimension by saying that time is important. It's here now, but it's not here now. So you can sort of think of that as a dimension too. But that's what we really mean when we say we live in three-dimensional space.
Professor?
Yeah?
Do dimensions beyond the third, and besides time, because that was kind of just an example, right, of a different way to think about it, do dimensions besides 1, 2, 3 come up in your work at all?
They do, and we will talk a lot about that later in the class. So we can talk a little bit about time as well, and there, I think, using an analogous sort of definition, I would say it's a fabric where we measure when things are. Again, it's a relative thing, because I can measure when something is relative to something else, and I can sort of define a zero of time, if you will. And in a sense, we have with the division between A, B, and C, we sort of have a zero there. But that's a pure human construct. Is there truly a zero in time? I mean, actually, a lot of this class is going to end up talking a lot about, you know, is there really a start to our universe or not? But let me ask you a question. Why do we need time? How do we know that something like time has to exist?
Because we can visualize accumulations and something that we see is constant, like something dripping into a cup.
Without time, we couldn't measure change. I mean, if you didn't have time, it'd be a static, boring universe. But if you look at water dripping into a cup, you can see that things actually change. So somehow this whole idea of change requires this strange concept of time. So let's just get something very clear, though. I think that you all have an intuition of space and time. What is that intuition? How does it all fit together?
Like you can feel the difference between like a long period of time and a short period of time. Pure alarm clock like breaks, you'll probably wake up around the same time.
There's internal clock. That raises an interesting question, which is time in a physical sense and time in a biological sense. I mean, if I'm up here doing jokes, this hour goes by very fast. If I'm really dry, if I start reading some of my scientific papers too, this hour will last a very, very long time, right? So biologically, that you perceive, but let's now think about it in terms of just sort of physical.
Are you looking for the intersection of space and time?
Well, they do intersect, right? I mean, we live in space and time. So I guess I'm trying to get at what is your real vision of what that is? Is it the same here as it is in California? Your position has changed, but you perceive the world around you pretty much the same way. Right? And time works well for us as a society because by its very nature, it's the same for everybody. So it turns out that we have a very particular, strong intuition that, you know, we understand. We live in three dimensions. We make use of it all the time. And it's sort of intuition. Certainly when you learn about coordinate systems, you might think about it more the way I was presenting it. But to find the corn nuts in the grocery store, it's, you know, how many aisles down, how far down, which shelf. So there's three numbers it takes. So that's three dimensions. It all looks the same, whether I'm running past the grocery store or whether I'm walking. Whether the grocery store is in California, the shelving may be different because it's a different grocery store, but basically everything looks the same. So you perceive the three dimensions of space in a sense. You can imagine the three dimensions of space encompassing our entire universe, and you think of it as flowing through time, all lockstep at a constant rate. And if you did not grow up with that intuition, I don't want to be anywhere near you when you're driving a car on the interstate. Because basically, that is what works for us. The concept of time makes no sense if we distribute watches and the time you get on your watch depends on, you know, what floor you were on in the library, how fast you were running, whether you went swimming yesterday. I mean, it doesn't work that way, right? It goes with this. Okay. So.
But isn't time different as different, like, position, like how high you are or how deep?
Well, we'll talk about that. But I mean, at first, I'm trying to agree on what our bias is,
yeah,
and what our vision is. And so today we're talking about. That's our intuition. Now, it is more than just a bias or an intuition, because, as we're going to learn, classical physics is built with that vision in mind. And classical physics works really, really well for almost everything in our experience. Okay? So I used a little hedge word there. And that hedge word turns out to be really important later on, because it doesn't quite work, and quantum mechanics and relativity and everything are revolutions that sort of led to lots of really fabulous things. But in the end, one thing I just sort of wanted to impress upon you is that this vision of space and time isn't crazy. It's what we grow up with, so really it is an innate thing to us. And it really serves us well. And it's really, really great stuff. So, in order to do a measurement, then sort of the simplest things to think about are position and time. And so I want to talk about those a little bit and then build on those concepts a tiny bit. So if we want to talk about position, we sort of have to define things in terms of units and in terms of how we measure it. And in terms of sort of the symbol I'm going to use, I'm going to say that position, I'll use the symbol X. Which will be the position along some particular axis. I'll say call it the x-axis, which in our hall we could, you know, we'd say that's the distance from that corner along this way, you know, along that direction if we want. And if we needed to do multiple dimensions, I could define an axis going this way, an axis going that way, and we could call one y and one z, etc. But we would have to agree on what it is. It isn't anything that came down from a mountain in stone. Every problem, you have to define what you mean when you're talking about your coordinate system. the idea of so many meters above sea level works because we all agree what the zero is, so it's meaningful. Latitude and longitude work because we have, as a world, agreed on what the zeros are and what the units are. So it's now a coordinate system that makes sense. If we want to talk about the Hoyt coordinate system, it may make sense to us, but it makes no sense to anybody else in the world. But that's okay. It doesn't mean it's useless. It just means we have to define what it is to mean. So there's nothing particularly special about that, and we can use different coordinate systems. And coordinate systems get really weird. Latitude and longitude is. You can define a coordinate system the way we normally think about it, this Cartesian, which is the axes are right angles and go so many this way, so many that way, so many up. But I could just as easily define a coordinate system where here's the zero, and my coordinates are how far out from zero is something, that is a radius, what angle down from straight up is it, and what angle is it this way? And that would be called spherical polar coordinates, and it works just fine, okay, for certain problems. So part of what your physics geeks and math geeks have to get good at is doing things in these different strange coordinate systems. And what you find, you know, they all can work. So it's sort of the same thing in principle. They all may be very different. Technically, there are certain problems which have spherical symmetry where using the spherical polar coordinates is exactly what you want to do. And if you try to solve that problem mathematically using Cartesian coordinates, you'd rather shoot yourself. So there's, you know, you do make lots of technical choices to do things, but it's not written in stone how to do it. Relative positioning is very important. So if I have, you know, something is at position 1 and it's moving along and it's at some position 2, then I can define the distance x2 minus x1. I'll often write as change in x or delta x. Delta is a symbol we often use for change. And so we have a concept of speed, which is, you know, something is going slow if its position doesn't vary very much with time. It's going fast if it covers more ground in shorter time. Right? So we define the speed of something to be basically the change in some generic position variable with respect to time. Usually we use the symbol t for time. If we use the word velocity, in English, I could have used it the same way. Something has a small velocity if I cover a little space and a certain amount of time. Large velocity if I cover a lot of space in a certain amount of time. Not critically important for this class, but probably good to know if you don't already know it. There is a distinction between velocity and speed. I do think that generally we sort of use them interchangeably in language. In physics, they're very different. Speed is the distance you cover in a certain amount of time. Velocity is that, but velocity requires that you also have the directional information. So if I go 5 miles an hour this way, or I go 5 miles an hour that way, those are actually different velocities. They're the same speed. So velocity contains directional information. And just because I'll probably slip, if you do a calculation with the velocity, you have to have that directional information in it. So in fact, you can't just use numbers. Like, I can quantify speed by a number, 5 miles per hour, 10 miles per hour. Okay. For velocity, I can't do that. I have to define it as 5 miles per hour east, or 5 miles per hour west, or 5 miles per hour, 10 degrees south of west, or something. So it's a very different sort of thing. And it turns out that that what you do is you represent velocity with a mathematical quantity that is actually different from a number. And we call it a vector. You can think of it as an arrow, where the arrow points in the direction that you're moving, and the length of the arrow tells you how fast you're moving. So I would make this arrow 5 units long if it would represent 5 miles per hour, and I would point the arrow this way if I was going that way, and I'd point it that way. And so there's this whole area of mathematics that's built up where you manipulate these strange arrows, which we call vectors, instead of numbers. And so this is the bane of Physics 113 and Physics 121 students. And it turns out that the directional information is very important, and that it leads to things that you're not quite expecting. If I take 5 miles per hour and I then increase it by 5 miles per hour, I can add those together and I'm going 10 miles per hour. It makes sense. If I'm in a boat that's going 5 miles per hour directly across the Genesee, and the Genesee is flowing at 5 miles per hour this way, what direction do I go? I not only don't go 10 miles per hour, I go some strange number, which turns out to be the square root of 5 squared plus 5 squared, so it would be like Pythagorean theorem. But I also go that way, because my boat's taking me that way, the river's taking me that way, they both operate independently, and they end up adding together to give me something over here. So this whole idea of addition of these velocities is really very different from what you get when you just talk about adding numbers. So it's a complicated business. But people know how to do it, and it works. Note that the velocity has a dependence on the position. You have to understand position and how it changes with time to sort of get at velocity. But they're independent. I can have something that has a speed here and over there, and they have the same speed or same velocity, and it doesn't. So if I want to describe, for example, this chalk, I not only have to tell you where it is, I have to tell you if it has a speed or not. And that speed may be zero, which may be how I would describe it, just sitting here. But it turns out that to really describe something, you not only have to tell its position, you have to know its velocity as well. In fact, more than that, there's yet another thing that can happen to it, which is its velocity could be changing. So generally, we give it a symbol V for velocity. But if you can imagine that velocity is changing with time, so what I mean by that, I have a certain velocity and it's growing. So if you look at my velocity there, it's small. You look at my velocity here, it's big. Okay, it is changing with time. And we call that acceleration. So it turns out that if you know the position, the velocity, the acceleration, and the time for any particular object, then you have a good description of that object in terms of its relation to space and time. You have a complete picture. But you're required to know, if I have an object here and I want to know where it is in 30 minutes, I have to know where it is now, what its velocity, what its acceleration is, and what its time is, and then it turns out I can calculate where it will be in 30 minutes. But I have to have that complete information.
Do you need to know about the black environment? There's friction?
Yeah, I mean, in principle, I may need to know some other things. We'll talk a bit about that in a second. But we call these our kinematic variables. And if you know these, you sort of know everything. Or a way to think about it is, if you know this for an object as a function of time, you sort of know everything there is to know for that object. In a sense, if you ask, what does it mean to understand a system or to understand the universe from a physics point of view, it would be almost as if I could tell you that for every object, then I pretty much know what the universe would look like and I understand why it evolves that way. So that's sort of it. So these pieces sort of tie together in the world in which we live, and we can find relationships with these. There's one piece missing that we have to pull in, and or several pieces, I guess, but they go by Newton's laws. So Isaac Newton is one of these amazing individuals. Lived in England, 1643 to 1727. He's one of these people that was able to, almost everything he touched turned to gold. He wanted to understand the motion of objects, so he's thinking about these kinematic variables and how these things may change. And he came up with what we call Newton's laws to sort of try to understand how that works, which we're going to talk about. On top of that, though, we found out in order to do it, he had to understand how things changed over short periods of time. And basically, he invented the mathematics of calculus in order to do what he wanted. He also did the basic law of gravity that we use and understand, which you can then use to... He did this. Basically, you can use it to understand the motion of planets. Now, talk about something interesting. Can you imagine you're playing around with these variables, you're playing around with thoughts of what forces are, you come up with something that you think works as a force calculation for gravity, and you then calculate the orbits for the planets and realize that you figured that out? That's a huge thing, right? I mean, I don't know. So he's an amazing guy. He published sort of the basic laws of mechanics, which are the foundation of physics, in forgotten the year exactly. 16. I can't read it. What year did he do that? At any rate, maybe I say. But it's called Principia, and it's really hard for me to overemphasize how important this contribution is. Everything that you know in your experience basically, in a sense, can be understood in his framework. Outside of things that involve electricity and magnetism, so that can be pretty important, and things that are really small or going with very large velocities or extreme density or something like that. So basically, it's most of our everyday lives can be understood in the mechanics of this, what he laid out in the Principia. So it's a huge contribution. This is what happens if you mix geeks and scotch. It's too dark in here. Too dark. I had a friend who is on the faculty at Oxford, and I was visiting him. We had too much scotch, and he just happened to have a key to the rare book library. So we went in there about 3 a.m. took pictures holding all these books, and I get pretty horrified when I look at this and realize, geez, I had gloves on. I was like... However, it was a total high point of the meeting. That's when I knew, when I realized how happy I was about this picture, I thought, holy crap, a complete unrepentant geek. Just absolutely. So, at any rate, Newton's laws. So I want to give you some sort of introduction to these. We're not going to do calculations and things with them, but we can. A lot of it is very... When you're used to what they're saying, when you realize what they're saying, they are very intuitive. Oddly enough, in many ways they're counterintuitive, and it's amazing that he had the insight to do this. So let me give you a flavor for what I mean. So his first law says that a body persists in a state of motion unless acted on by an external net force. Okay. And in a sense, what he means by force is defined in his second law, which we call the force law, which says that the acceleration of an object is proportional to the net force applied to it and inversely proportional to the mass of objects. F equals ma, is what it means. So that is, if an object happens to accelerate, there must be a net force on it. So that's sort of... I mean, if I ask you, what does it mean if you feel a force? How do you know when you feel a force? Usually, if you stop and think about any time, what you mean is you're often feeling accelerated. You have a force on you right now, which is the force of the Earth pulling on you. You don't go crashing to the center of the Earth because you have another force, which is the force of the sea pulling you up, and the two cancel out. So you don't have a net force. But if you get rid of the seat, okay, if you stand on your chair and you jump out so the seat is not supporting you anymore, you do fall towards the center of the Earth. So you're accelerated towards, so there's a net force on you. At any rate, so if we go back to this first one, we call it the law of inertia. A body in motion persists in that state of motion unless acted on by a force. Well, that's crap. If you've ever pushed a car, you know it's crap, right? Because you push the car, you finally get it going, and the minute you stop pushing, it stops. You take a box of books and you push them, they stop. So in our experience, this really isn't so obvious, okay? And the reason for that is this whole net force idea. There are other forces that are at play, which may not have anything to do with you pushing on. So friction, for example, if I push on this box of books, I have to keep pushing hard on it to keep it moving. And why? Because there's also a force that opposes its motion from the two surfaces, the surface of the floor and the surface of the box, rubbing against each other, which is a force we call friction. But if you can remove friction from the equation, then it's different. If I have this thing sitting on this bar and I push on it lightly, which I'm going to do only very lightly because I don't actually want to do it, I don't want to scratch anything. But I'm pushing on it, you can't see that. But I am, and it's not going anywhere. And the reason it's not going anywhere is there's friction between the surface that is effectively, I'm not overcoming because I'm not pushing it hard enough. I can overcome the friction. I can push with way more force than the friction can muster, in which case it will go. But another thing I can do is to basically remove the friction by sending air through this thing and having the air come out the sides. So it's sort of like if you've ever played air hockey, it's the same sort of thing. So now, if I put this body in motion, stay in motion. And I'm acted on by a force. So in fact, that first law is pretty insightful. I mean, I guess Newton had frozen poems he could have played with, but he didn't have air hockey tables. And that's not so intuitive, but it's very powerful. Okay, so number two, the force law, F equals MA. Well, that I think is pretty intuitive. If you've ever played football or something, you know what it is. Right? Would you rather get hit by a big linebacker or a puny guy like me in football, right? You'd much rather I hit because my mass isn't so great. Which means for a given acceleration, for a given force that I can put on you, you're not don't say it's if you try to shove somebody very big with a certain force, you'll only get them to move so much. If you take the same force and exert it on, put it on a small person, you can get a big change, right? The doors to Rush Reese are a pain in the butt to open because they're so heavy. So you have to exert a big force to get the things to open, right? So this is sort of everyday life. You're safer if you drive a big car than you are a little car, because if a big car and a little car hit, the little car has a bigger acceleration because its mass is smaller. That's sort of a bad example because we need to talk about number three. It's called the law of action and reaction. So what that says is for any force, there is an equal and opposite force. So I push on the railing. It may seem sort of weird, but the railing is pushing on me. How do I know? Because I'm not falling down. There has to be a force on me pushing back. Otherwise, I should fall flat on my face. So, if you exert a force on something, it exerts an equal and opposite force on you. And this turns out to be there are lots of examples of this. A tube on wheels. The wheels basically remove friction. Dry ice, which I can put in the tube. Dry ice is frozen carbon dioxide, so as it warms up, it just turns into gas. And I'm going to put a stopper in the tube. And now we're going to watch it for a second. Sometimes more than a second. All right, so what'd you see?
Force back on it, so it pushed back.
So the gas is expanded. Finally, the cork pops. So the cork goes this way. In order for the cork to do that, it has to accelerate because it starts out with zero velocity and it gets some velocity at this point, so it goes flying off this way. So there has to be a force on it. What exerts the force? This thing exerts the force on the cork. Okay? But by the law of action and reaction, the cork exerts an equal and opposite force on this thing. So this thing has to go backward. That's what you mean by the recoil. The cork went faster. That is, its acceleration was bigger. In the same amount of time, the cork's velocity went from zero to something bigger than the velocity of this did. It did get a velocity going this way, but it was relatively small. Okay? That's because this is heavier than the cork. If it were the other way around, if this were really light, it was a massive cork, then the cork would have just plooped a little bit and this would have gone flying back. Okay. So you can see examples of that. Here I have two of these.
they're pressed together and held by string here. The string is what's actually holding them together. So if I burn the spring wants to expand, and it will exert a force on each of these. These each have the same mass.
Thank you.
equals MA. And we have the law of action reaction, and we have the law of inertia. So we'll talk a bit more about that, but there's a fairly deep relationship between these things. They're all tied together. So we'll learn that the force of gravity at the surface of the Earth is basically a constant over the distances that we deal with it. If we get in a rocket ship and we go far away, it will drop off. But for the kinds of distances we typically talk about near the surface of the Earth, the force is actually constant. So there's a deep relationship between position, velocity, and acceleration. So if I exert a force on this thing, get it moving up, it does what balls do when you throw them up in the air. And you can mathematically describe that. So if we just think of how the x position changes with time, it looks something like that, like a parabola. The force is constant. So that means the acceleration, if we define positive being up, then the acceleration is constant because F equals ma. The mass isn't changing, so the force is the same. So the force is constant. The acceleration is going to look like some negative value down here, constant. It turns out to have a value of 9.8 meters per second squared. The velocity is going to be changing with time. The velocity turns out to be the slope of the position time graph. Do you care? The acceleration is how the velocity changes with time, so it's sort of the slope. The acceleration isn't changing, so what that means is that the velocity, if we define up as positive, starts out as big and positive because it's moving fast. As it goes up, it slows down. At the very top, it has a velocity of zero, and then it starts speeding up, going down with negative velocity. And it turns out that if we look at the velocity graph with respect to time, it'll look something like this. It'll be constant slope, but it'll start out big and positive and then get down to zero and then go negative. So we're not going to worry too much about all the details of these kinds of analyses and stuff, but I just, they're all tied together, okay? And if I take the mathematical relationships, sort of these relationships for position and time, and I add to that Newton's laws, where F is equal to ma, then it turns out I can set up a mathematical framework where I can understand how these vectors will change with time. So if we take our kinematic variables and we add to them Newton's laws, then it turns out we can develop a framework, a mathematical framework, where we can calculate how the things will evolve in time. And in Newtonian world, we can do that exactly. So a way to think about that is, I mean, that may not sound so exciting. you can put it in terms where it becomes a little more exciting. If you want to shoot a cannon and hit something, you have to calculate where it's going to go. So you have to know what force you exert on it. You have to know what the forces are on it as it travels. So air friction is a piece of it, but maybe you want to just ignore that. You can take just gravity, and you can calculate where the shell is going to land. We did a not very many introductory physics labs are all that exciting, but I remember we did one when I was a TA at Columbia for the students there, where we had ball bearings, which was a metal marble, that rolled down sort of a cupped inclined plane that looked like that. So the thing would roll down and get launched off like that. And you could, we actually calculated where the marble should hit on the floor. And we put a dime on that spot. And you could actually hit the dime. It was sort of cool. I mean, it's sort of neat. So to put it in a different way, if I had a big enough computer and I was able to input into that computer the position, the velocity, and the force on every object in the universe, I could calculate where everything is into the future ad nauseum. The kinematics variables plus Newton's laws give us an completely deterministic universe in principle. It's just a matter of computing power and getting enough information and understanding those forces well enough. And it is all situated in three dimensions with time going in one direction at a constant rate. So the whole idea of, understanding the universe in a sense physically is completely within grasp. It is entirely deterministic at that point of view. What do you think about that?
You can't calculate what people think.
You calculate what people think. Now that's a load. Maybe. Or we haven't talked about chemistry and stuff yet, but if we argue that human thought is manifest in the organization of particles in the brain, and it is the change in those with time that gives you different thoughts, so it's a very physical universe, then yes. If I knew where all your particles were and I could calculate where they would be in the future, maybe I could even predict thought. Yeah.
I mean, this is a system that's kind of broken by chaos theory, right?
It's actually, chaos may mess up some things, but quantum mechanics is what really does it. But it's very alluring. And I sort of want to paint the alluring picture for you. It's hard for me to emphasize the breadth over which this works. Yeah.
Okay, one point was that I thought we just got lost in the discussion. This is the classic role. You're setting a background.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Your statement kind of sounded a little strong, but that was the standpoint of the time. This was like,
that's my point.
This is like the higher of mechanical clocks. This is what Einstein was born, that's what was going on at the time. He was in Germany, correct? and they were clockmakers. This is very much like above you at the time, right?
Yeah, Switzerland. But, so yes.
So we learned more. This is where we start.
Oh yeah, we're going to talk a whole lot about new stuff. But I think part of the point I wanted to make is before we launch into ways in which this isn't true, I would like to sort of try to impress upon you how amazing this actually is and how much it works.
Right.
I mean, the truth is, if I ask you to think of your everyday life and give me an example in principle where this doesn't work or doesn't explain it, the truth is you would have to think of things that involve electricity and magnetism. And that you can come up with. So this doesn't... Lightning is sort of outside the realm of what we're doing here. You can add to this the theory of electricity and magnetism, which we'll talk about. And when you do that, along with Einstein, with the theory of gravity, which Newton came up with, which we haven't talked about yet, you basically encompass, you can calculate, you can encompass almost anything that we'll experience. It's amazing how amazing and useful this is. And this was sort of the situation at the end of the 1800s. This really worked. Electricity and magnetism, we'll talk about, really worked. It explained almost everything. There were a few little things people were working on that we didn't quite understand the framework. But quite honestly, young physicists were being told not to bother to go into the field because we already knew everything. Seriously. And I think there's really good reason for that. Our bias, our intuition really works well. This stuff really works well. Okay, so that's sort of the background for launching into some other strange things that we're going to talk about. So I'm out of time. But have a good weekend.
We had a problem with the professor. Didn't like me being late sometimes.
Sure.
And I don't want the aggravation as much as you wouldn't if you found it.
No, I understand. You have no need to apologize.
Right.
You have to do what you do.
I have a job, so 2 until 4 was my prime time, Monday, Wednesday. So I have to kind of teach people that it's no longer that way, and I was on the phone.
Okay.
So, all right. So is that the best thing to do? Is just scooch in there?
I have no problem if you come on down and.
All right. No, I just didn't want to. All right.
You know, if you come in singing rap music, you know, then it's disruptive.
Right.
But if you come
class.
In and sit down, that's fine.
All right. Great. I was glad to not miss this lecture. You know. And do you, can you illumine me when the recitations are tonight? If it's not possible, I guess
I can
look it up. Well, that's cool. Well, I'll look it up on the, it's on your website, right?
It is, but I can also pull it up for you in just a second. I just wanted to write this before. That was not good.
What device are you using?
It's a tablet PC.
I like it.
This is what I want. Okay.
What's it called?
This is just a tablet PC. It's a Fujitsu. Is the company
that does
this.
Oh, it's a tablet. It's a PC that flips around.
Yeah, it's a tablet. That,
using Windows 8?
Yeah, sorry. This one uses Windows 7.
Cool.
It was a lot cooler, you know, 8 years ago before everybody was going around with
tablets. Well, the mouse is what I miss, and I like how you hovered your stylus in the show. That's what's missing. I'll let you talk to her.
All right, well, if you want that time, let me tell you what it
talk
is.
To her.
Okay.
Does Newton, like, the whole kind of the variables plus Newton law thing measure, like, curve space time?
No. In this picture, space-time is immutable and
everything.
No, it doesn't at all. But that's what I was saying, sort of within your everyday experience. Curved space is something that's not, that I would argue is not really in your experience.
Yeah.
In fact, doing measurements of curved space phenomena, it turns out to be really hard.
Yeah, but I remember like Hawking or someone did a measurement like how the sun, like the light from Earth, so it actually
Eddington.
Proved
the Yeah, we'll talk about it. Yeah. We'll talk a lot about relativity and general relativity and curved space. Yeah.
There's a philosophy question in my philosophy class, like, you can't be in the same place, like, something like that, but I think it's quite, like, popular about you can't be in the same place, like, at the same time twice or something like that, but isn't that solved by multiverse?
450 and 740 would be the two times. Did he leave? Oh, yes, sorry. So you were saying?
Like, you can't be in the same place, like, at the same time twice or something like that. Isn't that so, if the space is curved and there's...
If the space is curved enough...
I mean, if there's a wormhole or something
yeah,
like that.
Yeah, you might have some strange things
yeah,
happening.
Yeah, but that would be the case. Like, you can be observed to be, like, at the same space.
Well, that would be really weird.
I'm in the intro philosophy class right now, and so many stuff, like, just logically can be true in the sense of multiverse.
No, yeah, I think we're going to talk about a lot of strange things that you'll probably also talk about some in philosophy. When you have curved space, yeah, things, very strange things can happen.
So are we going to learn about, like, dark energy? Because I'm a little bit confused between dark mm-hmm. energy and, like, dark matter. Like, I think they're kind of...
Well, they're very different, but we will talk about them. Yeah, these are all essential for understanding cosmology and...
And in
visions.
The NOVA documentary thing,
yeah.
Like it mentions, there's a guy said it might be that gravity can be like blowing everything apart instead of getting everything together in some sense. Does that like kind of...
Yeah,
it's like
I mean, it's dark energy.
Know.
We'll talk about it. Gravity is... So... In general relativity, what we call gravity, the theory of gravity, is really a theory of the curvature of space and time. And it turns out that energy within this theory curves space and time. And in principle, you can write down a theory that works, of where you basically can describe the curvature of space and time. And when you have that description, it determines the evolution of it. And you can adjust that theory in such a way that space-time is flat, like Cartesian space, like we think about. You can adjust it so that it has a different curvature, in which case it'll sort of collapse in on itself. Or you can adjust it so it has a curvature that's the other way, in which case it'll sort of blow apart. It'll have a repulsive force. So when Einstein first came out with general relativity, he realized it had this flexibility. And he said, well, and it's sort of a human bias thing, he said, I don't like that. I think we've lived in a static universe as far as I know, therefore, and he put a particular constant in his theory that tuned the energy such that space-time was flat, so the universe basically was stable. And we've discovered since then that the universe is actually expanding, and we'll talk about the evidence for that and everything. And so it turns out that we do have this expansion. And so for many years, people measured the level of this expansion, and we sort of thought that in fact the expansion should be slowing down, that the gravity within the universe would be sort of stopping the movement and slow it down, and it might come to a stop. It turns out, and this is not really that old in terms of science, I mean, like within 10 years ago, we've discovered that in fact the expansion is accelerating. So what that means in this equation, there's basically a term that represents some characteristic of space that gives you the algebraic sign in this, such that you get this expansion accelerating. It's actually moving apart faster and faster. In order for that to happen, you have to put in this new term. This new term has energy units, okay? And we don't know what it is. We know roughly what size it is, but we do not know what the essence of the space is that leads to it. So right now, we just call it dark energy. And we're trying to understand what it is.
Okay, so basically it's more like a theory, like we kind of know there's something exists, but we don't know.
Experimentally, we know that there is something in our universe that's causing it to accelerate in its expansion. It is consistent within the theory of general relativity, which insofar as we know works, okay? It is consistent within that theory of putting a term in what we call Einstein's field equations, which are the equations that govern the evolution of the universe, that has energy units, and we don't know what it represents. For example, I can measure the mass in the universe, and I can put a term in the equation that represents that. And because I have mass that exudes gravity, which is attractive, as this thing is blowing apart, the gravity wants to slow it down. So there's a term that's causing it to slow down, which I know what it is. It's due to gravitation and the mass in the universe. But there's another term that's causing it to expand, and I don't know what it is. So that's called dark energy. We're not totally clueless in the sense that we do have ideas. There are mechanisms. We have ideas of things that might make that happen. But we have not experimentally figured out what it is yet. In fact, we're still trying to quantify it to some extent.
In the email, say like possibility can be like different possibilities, like different multiverse. And
yeah.
But what if, like you said, there's one kind of universe that's like based on space. What if someone's space is like there's nothing else?
Well,
that would be also a kind of multiverse.
So that works for them. I mean, in terms of if you want to say a faith base, if you allow for that, then